The Kevin Smith Show, unique in the galaxy.
Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks. Welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this gorgeous place we call Earth. Thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. Some of you are joining us for the very first time. Welcome aboard. I'm glad you're here. Hope you make a habit out of it. Those of you who watch this show on our internet TV station can see that we are not in the same surroundings that we were. That is because the studio moved over the weekend. Same address, different room in the suite. So we don't have everything all in yet. A little barren back there behind me, I know that. But, that's the way it is, and besides, it is a radio show. Also, speaking of that, those of you who are listening via radio, or if you're listening to our radio feed via internet or cell phones, that's in stereo. The TV channel tonight is in mono, and we're not quite sure why, but we'll get that fixed. You've been watching television, you've been watching the news, and you know that there is a great upheaval taking place over in Iran. And I've gotten a bunch of email from people saying that even though I don't like to talk politics, they really wish I would do a show about this. Well, I'm going to keep the show focused on the things that we talk about in our genre. It isn't politics, however, when you talk about basic world events. That's not politics. But I will just say this, and I'll say it only because I've been very, very touched by the story of this 16-year-old girl who was shot dead in the streets of Tehran. And you've seen the videos on TV. I think they say her name is Neda, N-E-D-A. There are some lessons that most of us need to be reminded of, and some people are learning for the first time in all of this. First, we have been reminded that any government that puts its feet on the throats of its people has doomed itself to revolution, and they need to be reminded of that. Second, I hope that this very tragic event with Neda and others who have been killed in these demonstrations and these protest marches over in Iran, I hope it reminds you of this. Any military, anywhere in the world, any police or militia, anywhere in the world, that would turn its own batons and guns against its own unarmed people are the terrorists. Doesn't matter if they've got on a uniform. Doesn't matter if, they hold rank. What matters is they were hired to protect people and not massacre people. And I hope we are reminded of that. There is yet another lesson for all the governments of this world, and that is there's more of us than there are of you. Never assume that you have a right to rule over us. You were hired to rule for us, not over us. We'll be back with Jay Newcomb Hodges, and we'll be talking about some really interesting stuff here tonight. Don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, Jay Newcomb Hodges. Now, I think a lot of you are familiar with him because of the books he's written and because of the appearances that he's made on other talk shows, and he's been consultant on some TV shows and movies as well. He is a senior scientist with a very, very large company. And we are privileged to have him with us this evening to talk about some of the research that went on behind this book that he's got out called The Mushroom Farms. Jay Newcomb Hodges, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show.
Hey, thanks, Kevin. Great to be here. It really is.
Now, how should I address you? Do you want me to call you Jay Newcomb Hodges, Mr. Hodges, Dr. Hodges?
Just call me Jan.
Okay, Jan. This book that you have about, it's called The Mushroom Farms, is a novel based on some research that you've done. And I found the storyline, the plot, absolutely riveting. And it really fits into the genre of what we talk about here on this show. So if you will, sort of give us a little thumbnail sketch of this book, and then we'll talk about the research behind it.
Okay. Well, the book itself is book one in a trilogy. The trilogy is called the 2012 Trilogy, if that brings anything to mind. The book one basically focuses on the Mayan calendar, what happens at 13.0.0.0, essentially when the world's supposed to end at 11:11 a.m. GMT, December 21st, 2012, and how the world governments essentially started preparing for it back, about 5, maybe 10 years ago by building underground facilities. And The whole premise is around a secret government program. In the book, we just call it Program 3938, which is the latitude, the north latitude of 39 degrees, 38 minutes across the United States, actually across the world. And it just deals with seven underground facilities scattered about along that latitude. And it kind of focuses on how a central computerized system is actually set up to monitor assets around the world. And all these assets are tagged. Now, in the world of visibility, tagging means things like RFID, barcodes, tagants. Those are liquid things that are applied to things that are printed or manufactured, things like that.
In other words, you can use a special type of ink or something that is encoded with a tag that can be followed?
Yeah, in the book we call it liquid code.
Okay.
And what it is, it's a 96-bit tagant, or let's say nanotube structure, that when it's programmed, all of the particles go from 1111 across to like 1001100, whatever your number happens to be. And by using 96 bits, that's a trillion, trillion numbers. That's every grain of sand on Earth. So essentially, if everything was tagged, we'd still have enough numbers left over. So this book one basically focuses on the implications of having underground facilities, which hold 7,000 people each, which is a very small amount, actually, compared to other facilities. Like in Russia, they have one that holds 50,000 people. Can you imagine that, how big that thing is? And It's mainly used for the continuance of government in case something happens, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And if one goes down, you still have a complete separate government set up in another one. So it's that type of scenario on this first book. And why is it called mushroom farms? Well, that's what they call these underground facilities. You know how they raise mushrooms. So, yeah. So this essentially, it's underground facilities waiting for Armageddon or whatever's going to happen on 2012, December 21st. So that's book one. Book two, actually, this book has been out for almost a year. And book two, which is called Continuance, will be out in about 3 to 4 weeks, which is like what happens next. So there'll be three in the series. It's like the first book is based on experiences, interviews, things that I've encountered. Now book two, the one that's coming out, is based on legends, interviews, tracking down. You know, I started putting together all kinds of legends and information. I kept getting emails from people when I was on other talk shows, and I started saying, well, there's got to be a connection between, like, the Mayans, the Sumerians, the Greeks, the Polynesian, the Asians, the North American native tribes, because, you know, they all talk about the same thing, you know, way back 6,000 years ago. So I started doing a lot of research into that and get in touch with tribal leaders and old guys that live up in the mountains, you know, that have been writing these things down and all this stuff. So book two is really focused on what actually is underneath the mushroom farms. You know, what is really the secret there? So book two focuses on that.
And it'll be out in two or three weeks?
Yeah, in about 2 or 3 weeks. And what it comes down to is a race that came to Earth 6,000 years ago called the Havmusuvians. And actually, everybody says they like to be called the Musuvians. And that's basically where the story starts.
All right. Let's dive off into some of the background on all of this stuff. First of all, a couple of questions.
Sure.
Do these underground mushroom farms exist in actuality? Do they actually exist?
There are underground facilities, yes, and I named quite a few of them in the first book, and you know, and I talk about, you know, what's basically inside of these things, and it's not any real secret, you know. It's like complete. Every office you can think of in the government is represented in some of these sites, you know, for the purpose of continuation of a government,
mm-hmm.
And it's no different than what we have up. You know, in the Arctic Circle with our seed farms or seed storage. It's, you know, for continuation. And they're all tied together by communications and transportation capabilities. It's underground cities, no different than what you'd find in Singapore presently today. They have a complete city underground. It's,
all right. I want to come back to that, but my second question, this Tagint technology, does that actually exist today?
There's many forms of Tagint. There's Tagints that can show up under infrared light. There's Tagints that can be vibrated by certain frequencies, like a nanotube. The great thing of a nanotube is it can be switched on and off like a tunneling diode with the right frequency. So if you have the right sequence of frequencies on a patch of nanotubes, it will actually put off a specific number over and over again. And once it's burned, we call it burned, once it's burned, it can't be changed. So that number stays there forever. There's other types of tagants, such as little thin wires. You'll find those in currency. There's, you know, something as simple as a small holographic image that can be activated by, again, different frequencies. You know, as I get into more and more of our talk, you'll see I'll be talking a lot about frequencies because that is the basis of everything.
All right. Now, do any tagants exist that are invisible to the naked eye?
Just about all of them are. until they're activated by some type of a waveform.
So you could actually be, we could actually be tagged and not even know it.
Really? Yes, that's right. Yes, it, yeah. But are you? No. At this point, I would say the probability is about 99.9%. You are not. But the things you have in your wallet, okay, if you carry around a wallet, if you carry, if you're dressed in clothing, if you have any tags on you, such as clothing tags, shoelaces, anything like that, anything that's manufactured can be tagged. And the reason for that tagging is for asset control, visibility, warehouse management, inventory control at the point of manufacturing and distribution. Now, to take advantage of that after the item is out, that's up to whoever wants to do that. The interesting thing about tagging, which people should probably realize today, is it doesn't have a range of like 100 yards or stuff like that. It's good for about 6 to 12 inches on a good day with the wind behind you.
Mm-hmm.
You actually have to be in very close proximity of, let's say, 90% of the tagants that are out there. Are there other things? There are things being developed, yes. There's things in experimental stages. There's all kinds of wonderful stuff. Now, the other type of tagging that they use prevalently everywhere is the RFID, radio frequency identification. And there's active RFID, which means there's a battery or some type of power that makes the tag send its information after it's turned, after it's activated. And the other is the passive RFID, which when you pass an antenna or some type of resonator, it powers up the tag. The tag then emits its identification code. And it'll emit it at 200 times per second. So it really screams and lets whoever or whatever's around it know it's there. Now, a lot of people are thinking, well, God, I could walk by somebody with a reader and they could know it's me. Well, no, because all of these informations, all the ID of every tag is in a relational database somewhere. What that means is if I read a tag and it said 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, it would mean nothing unless I could find the exact database where that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 shows up and tells me what that item is. So there's a lot of safeguards in there, and there's a lot of concern for tapping into certain databases. But again, you really have to have your act together to be reading this information.
All right, I want to go back to these mushroom farms.
Sure.
Now, in you talked about the fact that there exists these underground cities, and we've all heard about these deep underground military bases, and we've all heard that they are like cities underground. In your book, you're dealing with some specific underground cities that you refer to as the mushroom farms. These are for the continuance of government. In the real world in which we live, the continuance of government program is under the control of the office of the vice president. And I wonder, in your book, do you get into that any, and as to why it's under the office of the vice president?
No, I don't. I don't get too deep into it. The what I do refer to in there is the Executive Order 11490. Now, that's the executive order that was issued for the continuance of government. I think it was the Eisenhower era that established that. And the reason for that was we were in the Cold War. And it's like, holy cow, what if the nukes started falling on us? What the heck are we going to do? So they set up this executive order to build facilities that would house everything we need to continue the government. And we're not the only country that does this, okay? Every country does have some type of continuation contingency plan. And you just walk around the world and knock on the doors and say, where's your underground facility? And I think probably 80% of the public knows where they are. It's just you can't get into them, and it's going to be pretty darn hard to shut them down. So it's
Do they need to be shut down?
Well, in the case of, let's say, an attack, sure, you can take out a government, but how are you going to shut down the underground facilities if you can't get there? Because everything is underground. You got water, you got power systems, you have your communications, you have your transportation. So
I see what you mean. You mean it would be difficult for an enemy to disable them or shut them down?
That's correct.
Yeah.
So
okay, now, as you started doing your research for this book, you got into a lot of the information about 2012. Your book talks about a December agreement or December treaty. What's that all about?
Yeah, it's a December pact.
Mm-hmm.
December pact in the book is, we call it the surviving nations, okay, where they would cooperate. Let's say some catastrophe happens, some cataclysmic something, you know, anything. You know, we can go down the list of various, you know, the asteroids and on and on and on. Whatever governments are still in existence, there is a pact that they will work together to try to keep civilization going. Now, the minimum amount of people required to maintain a level of civilized technology, continuance, survivability is about 80 million people.
Okay. Does this pact actually exist?
There are understandings. Okay, if there were only two countries left on the planet after something big, and we came up above ground after 6 months or a year, the first thing we would do is not try to kill each other. Okay, we need resources, we need help, we need communication. We would be right back into the 16th, 17th century. Okay, we would have to start farming. It would be back to an agricultural civilization, basically. We wouldn't be sitting around running computers to monitor shipments of televisions. We would be back plowing the fields with probably horses, cows. As far as we could go with enough fuel, we could probably still use our automated equipment, but it would probably bring a lot of people closer together. But again, we would get down to this, down to levels of small community, rural mentality, almost down to a tribal level, bands, if you will. And being humans, you know, boy, we really like to fight each other. So, you know, we'd probably start all over again. You know, we got 10 guys from this village over here. Once come over here and get our berries, there's going to be a fight. So, no matter what we do, we're humans. We're stuck with it. We've made a great art out of killing each other. And no matter what happens, we will always be like that.
Well, it's the largest industry on the planet.
It is.
Yeah. And we're 10 seconds away from a break, and I want to get into that. Well, we're not even 10 seconds away. There it is. So I want to get into this a little deeper when we come back. All right, folks, we'll be back more with Jan Newcomb Hodges right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show and my guest, Jay Newcomb Hodges. Jen, when we went away for break, I said I want to delve into this a little bit more. You found some common threads in a lot of ancient civilizations. Now, your trilogy is about 2012.
Right.
Did you find that to be a common thread in these ancient civilizations?
Yeah, where I found the 2012 showing up the most was in the Americas. How's that? It's the North American, the tribes in North America, the Aztecs, the down Yucatan and down Peruvian area. The 2012 showed up a couple times in some ancient Asian stories. And let's see, where else was it? And some of the Polynesian, believe it or not, stories. Now, the exact date, you know, varied, but it was everything was close to the 2012. It seemed like that was where the crossroad between, they called the eras, between this era and the next. Now, whether it's a universal era, a new age era, but I wasn't hearing anything on anything coming to an end. The only thing that was coming to an end was the old ways.
Mm-hmm.
That could be interpreted a number of different areas, but it was appearing like it was no different than when our calendar is December 31st, you go out and buy a new one. It just starts a new era. But the new calendar was more focused on the human race taking the next step, okay? Now, the next step seemed to be in conjunction with someone else, okay? So it was like, again, we have to go back to the Mesuvians. That kept showing up a number of areas. In fact, the word mu, M-U, now I don't know how you pronounce it. I call it mu, Mesuvian mu, or mu. That was showing up forever in just about every text. In fact, in the Asian text, mu was the answer to an unanswerable question, which could only be answered by the gods. Now, again, we get back to these ancient gods coming down. They all came in their silver ships. They came down, taught us how to fish, make fire, just on and on, but they never taught us to make weapons. Okay? Now, I started putting this stuff together, and everything came up here to where I had this one line here. Everybody kept saying it, but it was essentially, we are here, the humans are here, essentially, we're going to teach them to protect us. We're going to teach them everything they know to protect us. Now, whatever that meant, whether this race was not warlike, they didn't have weapons, who knows? They were wrapped up in peace, art, literature, progression of their civilization. We're not sure. But it was like they had no warriors. So, well, look at this. We got humans. Geez, you know, they even kill each other. You know, they could protect us, but they don't have anything. So for the last 6,000 years, all these legends came down saying this is the way you progress. And here's the milestones you have to hit. And the last milestone is going to be December 12th, 2012, or December 21st, 2012. And that's when you should have all the information, all the technology you need to essentially take the next step. And the next step is not anything to do with this planet. They knew we were colonizers. They knew we were explorers. They knew we're running out of room on this rock. We have no more resources. There's too many people. So it's like, this is the perfect time. It's time to leave home. And that seems to be all the way through. I had a list, the Mayan, the Carol, the Olmec, the Supe, the Moche civilization, Central America, Peru, all of these had pretty much the same stories, along with the Rama Empire in India, the Shang Dynasty in China, the Aroi Kingdom in the Polynesians, Melusinia, the Micronesia people. I mean, it's all the same story over and over. You dig back. Now, some of them go back to 78,000 years with the Lemurian civilizations, and that's essentially when Atlantis existed in everybody's story. That was the foundations. But that only shows up on the, it shows up mainly in the Western civilizations. The Eastern civilizations, it was a little bit different. That only goes back like 6,000 years. So that's the only part that was waving back and forth. But I think they all agreed 6,000 years ago was when everything began, where we started to set up the human race for the next step.
The Mayan calendar comes to an abrupt halt on December the 21st, 2012.
Right.
Now, that calendar is based astronomically.
Correct.
Is it possible that the reason it comes to an end is because there will be something cataclysmic that will change all of the astronomical observations?
Well, the Mayans, I dug really deep into that, and they're saying the poles will shift. Well, we think of the poles as north and south pole, you know, the magnetic and all that.
Mm-hmm.
The Mayans were thinking east-west. Okay? All of their poles go from east to west. So their poles are going to shift from east to west. Now, it could be a power shift. Okay? So we just have to interpret it that way. If we go strictly for the pole, now that could be cataclysmic.
Well, if it's a power shift, this was something that the Bilderbergers back in the late 70s and early 80s made a decision that the wealth centers of the world had to shift from the West to Asia, which we have been watching happen since then. And so maybe that's the power shift that or the pole shift that they're talking about.
Could very well be. It's like that calendar is you're reading the book and the last chapter's missing. So, but there's enough clues in there, you know, and Mr. Mustard is in the library, but where's the candlestick? So you just have to work on that. And by looking at their civilization, the way they viewed things, such as their poles, their shift, dealing with, you go down to the Navajo people, okay, their whole thing was, I think, six or seven signs had to be in place before the big one. And essentially, I think there's seven. Six of them are already done. The last one was a network of spider webs across the world. Well, we have that now. It's called the Internet, telephones, all this. But it's interesting. Their last prophecy is a very large blue inhabited thing will fall to Earth. So, you know, again, somebody left out the last chapter. This is all going to happen in 2012. Again, you know, the Hopi and the Navajo and everybody, their prophecies are stating pretty much the same year. So again, I was talking about the Americas and the tribes, you know, the North American Native Americans, you know, they're all pretty much in line with this also.
Right. Now, what about as you have done this research and found out all these things, and with your background as one of the leading scientists in this country, how does that mesh? Do you see 2012 as being something that's going to be cataclysmic for us?
No, I do not. Flat out, I do not. But it will be the beginning of something.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it may not happen on that date. That may be the date something happened that maybe the world doesn't know about. It might have happened in a lab somewhere down in Cielo del Fuego. Who knows? But something will happen on that date that will affect the next era. No, I don't believe anything cataclysmic is going to happen. The only thing that could possibly happen is there's a solar flare that's supposed to happen in 2012. Now, people are saying, oh, geez, it's going to be humongous. Well, even with an X flare, something that large, it would only affect, let's say, we had one in 1958 that was pretty large. Okay, but we didn't know about it because we didn't have any computers. Nothing was digital. We didn't have any satellites up there. We didn't even know about it. It didn't really affect that much. If it did happen, it could shut down the Internet. It could shut down, let's say this. Here's something to think about. Anything with a microprocessor. Now, let's think. What has microprocessors? We have sewage. We have water treatment. Operations. We have power grids. We have automobiles. You know,
even your microwave
process. Microwaves. Mm-hmm. You know, anything, my little laptop sitting all over this room here, you know, they could be affected. Now, would they be totally whacked? I don't know. It depends on their shielding. It depends the intensity and probably the length of it.
Well, since you don't see personally that there's going to be a great cataclysm, let me invite you to a 2012 party that I'm hosting in Bangkok, Thailand, December 21st, 2012.
I like Bangkok.
It's a beautiful place. You've been there.
Oh, yeah. I live in all over the world.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Bangkok, Thailand, I'm going to be hosting a party. This is not a joke. This is true. I'll be hosting a party in Bangkok, Thailand, December the 21st, 2012. And you see, it's really safe because what I'm going to do, it'll be December the 22nd there. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be broadcasting live from that party as December the 21st dawns on America.
Okay.
And we're going to party all the way through as it dawns all the way across the United States.
Excellent.
Okay. And we're just going to have a good time. We'll have live music, great food, have a good time, and we know it's going to work because December the 22nd is where we will be because of the dateline, and they already made it. So December the 21st for this side of the world will be December 22nd there, and they already made it. So if this side of the world doesn't make it, we'll be where it already made it.
Well, on my calculations, it at 11:11 a.m. GMT on December 21st, 2012, the sun will be approximately straight on about 350 miles west of Windhoek in Nambia. So anything on that side of the world, probably for the next, 10 hours. So as the sun continues, that means it'll go across the ocean, it'll probably hit South America, probably Central America. By the time it gets to Hawaii, I think just some residual. You're right. Bangkok is totally, it's free and clear.
Yeah.
I'm looking at my calculations here. So, yeah.
Now, if this happens, if your timing is off a little bit and this thing happens on December the 21st in Asia, as opposed to this side of the planet, if it happens December the 21st there, well, it'll be December the 20th here, and we already will have known it, and we won't get on our airplane.
Yeah, with airplane.
We have to take a break. We'll be back right after this. Back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Jay Newcomb Hodges. Jan, we sort of took a little side trip there talking about the party in Bangkok. That's really true, and you are invited. I hope you'll come. Well, that didn't work out, did it? Oh, the joys of moving the studio, you know. So let's see what we can do here and see if we can get Jay Newcomb Hodges back on the line here. Well, you know, hey, we moved the studio over the weekend. What do you expect, right? Jan, are you with us?
Yeah, right.
All right. I was saying we sort of took that little side trip there and talked about Bangkok. But that's not a joke. I really am going to be hosting a party, and you are invited, and I hope you can come.
Oh, that'd be great.
Now, let's delve a little bit into this book, because the book does assume that a cataclysm is coming, right?
Yes, it assumes that.
Okay. Now, in this December pact that's presented in the book, each nation has got its underground facilities ready to go. The cataclysm comes, and people start pouring into these facilities. But only the select few get to go, right?
That's correct.
What happens to everyone else?
That I talk about that in the book. Man's wonderful, how we deal with our fellow brothers, you know, it's God, I can't believe it.
Who gets to choose? Who gets to choose the people that go into these survival bunkers?
It was the way the book is placed or laid out is a committee is set up to select people that would be no different than colonizing another planet. Who would be needed? What type of skills? And they had to narrow it down. I think they only get 80,000 people or some crazy thing. It was 8,000 people. 7,000 people per site or something, so times 7, so whatever that is. Then they have to choose based on their skills.
Mm-hmm.
And how that can be used, you know, to start over. And in the book, it's actually laid out. I did a lot of research into a number of scenarios, and I actually came up with some numbers on what would be required to repopulate our country after a big one. You know, how many people, what's the percentages, who would need what, and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just trying to look up the section here on it, but it's laid out in percentages, number of how many people have to be agriculture, how many have to be teachers, managers, things like that, security. And it was surprising that because of the agricultural society that would have to be regenerated, there's no computer people required. There's nobody required for any real technology. Some electricians, you know, to try to get some power going. A lot of the technology, because of what we have already, we can probably duplicate it if we had to start over, because we have that knowledge, because knowledge is power. And we would probably be getting more into windmills. There'd be enough stuff still laying around, you know, that we could operate, but nothing on a worldwide basis. We couldn't be running dams. Everything had to be localized down to, like where we were, you know, in the 1800s. So you just look back and say, what type of skills required in the 1800s? And that's what they look for. It's pretty sad, but that's reality.
Most people who are listening to me right now and listening to you have never, ever had to live where there is absolutely no modern convenience.
Yep.
Okay, so they go camping. Okay, well, you know, that's for a night or two, and you carry a lantern with you, and you've got flashlights and so forth. I lived for 2 years on an island, and this particular island, the place where I lived and worked for most of that time, was down in the jungle.
Uh-huh.
We had no running water. We had no electricity. And when people just think about it, and there was no, you know, like natural gas. You know, so you just think about this. That means 2 years without something cold to drink. There's no way to refrigerate it.
Yep.
you cooked over a wood fire, or I did get finally one real modern convenience, and that was a one burner propane. I guess you could call it a stove. Just a burner. And I could buy propane up in the capital city. And so I would buy enough propane for a month. But that was very modern. When night came, it was candlelight, if you had candles. And it was extremely hot, but there's no fans, no electricity for that, no air conditioning. And so most people have never had to live like that, and I really think a lot of folks simply could not survive. A lot of people living today could not survive that kind of lifestyle.
Nope. The research I did, you know, if we were going to go back then, actually, it would almost throw us back to Bronze Age in some cases. And what the numbers came up with is 38% of the population has to do farming, forestry, and fishing. 12% would be fabricators and laborers. You know, that's building huts and keeping things going. Craftsmen and repair people would be 22% because, you know, we still have stuff laying around here. Maybe we can keep stuff running. Cooks and service, about 13%. And down to the professional and managerial, such as medicine and stuff like that, would only be 10%. So you see the shift from where we are today.
Mm-hmm.
I think managerial and support services now take up about 60% of what we do.
Oh, yeah, we've got way too many chiefs.
Sure.
And, you know, having been in the police work for most of my adult life, I can say with great assurance that a great many of those people in supervisory positions, not all of them, but a great many of them, are completely and totally worthless. And, you know, in the military and in police, as with a lot of other businesses, you have to screw up to move up. And that's what they do with their problems. They give them a promotion and move them. And that's true in a whole lot of business, not just in police business, not just in military. It's true in a lot of business. People sitting in Washington think they know best about how police work needs to be done out here on the streets in Phoenix, Arizona. And that's not true. It's the guy pounding the beat out there that knows best. It's not some head of some consortium that knows best how to do research in a lab. It's the researcher that knows best, the people with their feet on the ground that know best how to do what needs to be done. And so one of the scary things to me in this scenario would be, and this is why I ask, who gets to choose? Because I think that the elite, and by elite I'm talking about high-ranking people in every industry, would think they are the most necessary. And in fact, it's the foot soldier that's the most necessary. Few generals ever fight.
That's correct. And I kind of address that in the second book, where on the first book you are absolutely right. The upper management picked the people to say, okay, if we were to recolonize, who would we need? Well, those numbers I just read you, they were totally upside down, because the present mentality, mindset of today's civilization said this is what we need.
All right, we have to take a break. We'll continue on the other side of this break, and then we'll open up the telephone lines for you. All right. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show and my guest, Jay Newcomb Hodges. We'll open the telephone line in just a moment. I got a couple of more things I want to cover with Mr. Hodges before we open the phone lines. So in your first book, Jan, they got the numbers all upside down. They got too many chiefs, right?
Yep, they sure did, because, you know, who's running the show right now.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, they finally figure out that it should be the other way.
Mm-hmm. The people who are needed for survival, I said, are the foot soldiers. And what I mean by that are people who actually know how to really do something and accomplish something. It's not the people who are philosophical or who put together proposals.
Yeah.
It's people that know actually how to do it.
Yeah, you're getting one of my pet peeves on the present educational system, what they're pushing. You know, it's we look at our industry. You know, where's our steel mills? Where's our automobile manufacturers? You know, it's everybody shifted to, I want to sit at a desk and do a computer thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I came from the Midwest, you know, becoming the great Rust Bowl now, and it really gets me, you know. We have some of the greatest workers on the planet. It's just, they were steered in the wrong direction, that's all.
Well, let me make a point, and then we'll move on. But a point that I'd like to get your observation on: in a real catastrophic situation, there are very, very few heads that are needed, and by that I mean chiefs.
Yep.
And then you need people who really know how to do something. You don't need a hospital administrator. What we need are doctors out there taking care of people in a catastrophe. And we're seeing this this evening with the very tragic train wreck that took place up in Washington, D.C. And last count, I think the last count I heard, there were four people dead. And about 60, I think, that had been sent to hospital, something like that. But the count was still going, so it's probably much more now. So what we need at the point of the catastrophe, we don't need chiefs. We need guys crawling up in there who know how to take care of this situation and then do it. Okay, now, if that's what we need when all of the bells and whistles break down, that is telling us that that's what really is keeping us going now. It's those people that are keeping us going now. At the base of everything, those who really know how to do something are the ones upon whose shoulders sit the civilization.
Very true. Not only now, but in the future. We have to go back, just a quick thing here. We just go back to the early 1800s. The first people that went west were the explorers. Okay, that's what we are. Human race are explorers. We went out there, we found what was going on, we mapped it. You know, after the real work was done, then we sent in the bookkeepers and yada yada yada, and just went downhill from there. And the same thing is going to happen when we start colonization. The first guys that are going to go up on those planets, on Mars and the Moon, are going to be nothing more than the old mountain men, just in a different form. But they have to have the same skills. And are we teaching that? I don't know. You know, do we have 10,000 people that we can send to colonize, you know, who could, you know, live like you did on the island, you know, with the capabilities of running today's technology, but surviving when they have nothing. So,
One of the things I saw this happen, and this really, I'm only speaking about Americans here because that's what I saw. That's what I am, and that's what I saw in this particular situation. that I'm about to tell you. But I we had some incidents where we brought in some police officers out of the capital city to help us with some special operations that had to be done. And these guys that I'm about to tell you about were Americans. And they got down into the jungle, and there, you know, when it came mealtime, there were several of them that said, "Oh, I'm not going to eat that." And I said, "Okay, well, what are you going to eat?" "Well, isn't there a restaurant in town?" and I said, "Well, there are a couple of houses where you can go and order a meal, and the family will fix you a meal, and it will be this." Okay, well, I'm not going to eat that. And okay, you know, people like that are going to starve to death. You have to learn that you eat what's available, and whatever the local people are eating, it's not killing them, so it's not going to kill you.
That's right.
And it may not be what Aunt Susie fixed for your birthday, but, you know, it'll keep you alive. And, you know, I'm talking about snakes and bats and rats and monkey and whatever is available. And you eat and you will live, you know.
Yep.
But you have to have that in your mentality that, you know, the thing here is not my taste. The thing here is to survive.
Well, what we're teaching today is whatever was yesterday will be the same as tomorrow. Don't worry about it. Learn how to run this program.
Mm-hmm.
What if tomorrow, all of a sudden, we're in the 16th century? You know, there's something's got to change here. I don't know. I just don't know.
Well, and could it not happen as easily as having an asteroid strike the Earth?
Yep. We think we're humans. You know, we're in control of everything. We've got it nailed. Boy, everything's under control. Well, no, nothing's under control because we're at the mercy of whatever's floating around our rock right now. It could just fall on us. We could have super volcanoes. We could have tidal waves, major earthquakes. You know, how do we deal with that? Well, for about 3 hours after any of those events, you know, we run around and look at the administrators who are hiding under the desks, you know. So, I can go hours on this, Kevin, but I won't.
Well, your book also has kind of a surprise in it. It's someone who has decided that these mushroom farms should not exist, right?
That's right. Somebody that wasn't invited to the club. Remember the original 8,000 that were chosen?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's going to be jealousy. There's going to be, I'll teach you. I'll just destroy everything. You know, that type of mentality. So, you know, I kind of focus on that a little bit. I don't call them terrorists in the book, but by golly, that's the same type of thing. How do we deal with that?
Mm-hmm.
And I rely on some technology, but again, I just rely on human ingenuity. Back to getting down to who we really are. How do we deal with this? And I think I bring a lot of issues on who we are, where we should be going, you know, where we've been, what we can't do, and what we can, and what decisions were made that shouldn't have been. What decisions were made that, you know, will probably save us. So,
during the research for this book and during the writing of this book, did it ever cross your mind that it might just be possible that this exact scenario has taken place in the past and that we are only now beginning to crawl up out of the Stone Age from which we were dumped back into?
You're pretty much talking about your guest last night, aren't you? Kind of fading back into that.
Well, it's just a theory that I've heard before, that I've heard it from several guests, a theory that there was at one time a very advanced civilization on the Earth. Some great cataclysm dumped them back into the Stone Age, and we are only now beginning to crawl out of that.
That's correct. That's that one thing I was talking about when I dealt with some of those older cultures, they were saying that, yeah, you know, we were back around here 78,000 years ago. You know, we had the Mu cultures, you know, with Atlantis. What do they call it? Lemurian civilization.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going through my notes. My glasses are all foggy. The Lemurian civilizations, and which were the underlying foundations for the legends of Atlantis and all that. And according to them, they had flying machines, you know, they could fly around, you know, yada, yada, underwater communication systems and all of this. And they kind of taught, you know, everybody how to do things, and they went their own ways. And, you know, it kind of focused on the seven orders of the seven tribes that finally evolved, that came about, you know, back, they called them the seven lodges. And that kind of shows up a lot around 10,000 years ago, 6,000, 4,000 B.C. And the first glimpse of that were the Sumerians. So, you know, if you kind of dig into that civilization a bit and go back in their legends, you're going to go, holy cow, you know. It really opens your eyes. So, true, you know, this we may be the fourth generation, you know, trying to finally make it. Will we? I don't know. You know, I'm just going along for the ride.
We will all find out the same day, won't we?
Well, we should, yeah. <You know.
laughs> All right, here's what I'd like to do. I'm going to open up the telephone line for folks to call in. And the telephone number, ladies and gentlemen, is 480-553-7232. 480-553-7232. And though we will not be able to talk about the specific nature of our guest's work, let me tell you that he is one of the top scientists in this country, and that's a fact. All right. And so what he's done is he's taken that background plus some research into. Some really, really ancient documents and ancient civilizations, put that together into a novel called The Mushroom Farms. And he has painted a picture of what 2012 and beyond may look like. Some of you think that perhaps 2012 is going to be a great cataclysm, and I don't ridicule that. I wouldn't. You may be exactly right. Some of you think it will not be, and I don't ridicule that. You may be exactly right. But if you've got a question, or if you've got a comment, either about the science that, you know, we talk a lot about this, Jan, we talk a lot about on this show about futuristic science, things we think sound futuristic but actually exist today already in one form or another. And so maybe you've got a question about some of this futuristic science that goes into the background of this novel. Well, if you do, the telephone number is 480-553-7232. If you live outside of the USA or you live outside of Canada, feel free to use our flash line, our flash message line. And the flash message line, well, we've lost our guest again. The flash message line, the way that works is you just go to our website and you scroll down. You'll see a link that says flash message, okay? And click that link. You can send me a flash message. All right. We've got a couple of flash messages already. Let's see. This one from South Africa. Nope. Sorry. That's from last week. This one has to do with Iran, so that's not what we're talking about tonight. This one says, does Jan have any opinions on Terrence McKenna's novelty theory, which apparently flatlines in December 2012? So what about that, sir?
No, I don't have any comment.
Okay. I'm not familiar with it. I mean, I've heard, well, that's not true. I have heard of Terrence McKenna. I have heard of the novelty theory, and that's all I know about it.
Okay.
So I don't know. So sorry from the United Kingdom there. Also from the United Kingdom, does Jan think there's any truth to the idea that the Mayans were measuring the acceleration of consciousness? Could the galactic central sun be playing a role? And is there any room for the mushroom farms, on the mushroom farms, for philosophers, poets, and dreamers?
Ah, interesting. Room on the mushroom farms for poets. Well, actually, there are quite a few of them on there, but that is not their primary function. If we have anyone who has any intellectual drive within them to better themselves, would have to have some poetic, something within them that gave them the passion. Okay. So what we find in a lot of these characters in the book, that kind of comes out, especially when they get locked down in there. And they start writing notes and little diaries and stuff. You see that come out, and that shows up towards the end of actually the second book. It comes out a lot when they find these journals and what people have written. So I don't think a poet as a occupation would be something they would look for. But there's poetic there's passion within all of us that comes out when we get into situations where there will be no tomorrow. So that does come out. As far as the Mayans, it was the philosophical connections what you're talking about?
Let's see. Do you think there's any truth to the idea that the Mayans were measuring the acceleration of consciousness?
Okay. Acceleration of consciousness. Oh, boy. If we delve into the stories of the Musuvians, where the Musuvians of that 6,000 years ago, their communication, oh boy, this is going to, I don't want to throw a lot of people here.
Well, that's okay. We're quite accustomed to very esoteric ideas.
Okay. Some of the power systems that you would see, I don't want to go way back to the Ark of the Covenant and all that, but some of these power systems were globes, and these globes essentially would take hydrogen particles that would essentially be attracted by the resonance within the globe. As the particles would strike the surface of the globe, the coating on the inside, I'm going to call it cesium or something close to that, would then generate electrons that would be thrown off into a central collector to create power. Now, how do you get these things to operate? Well, the whole thing about frequencies was how you get these things to turn down would be a sequence of notes or a sequence of individual frequencies, you know. And what they did, they came up with songs. Now, if you sang the right song at the right pitch, these things would come on. The consciousness, the would be to be able to project your thoughts, your consciousness into this globe through song. The progression was only the higher holy men, the priests and all this would know these songs because knowledge is power and you don't want to teach everybody this. So they could actually have these things turn on. They were actually communication devices. And if you had a mind, you could communicate. Now, with who? Well, whoever had another globe or whoever gave you that globe, you know, 250 miles up. So their advancement was more into a level they didn't understand. They just thought that the gods were talking to them if they sang the right songs, if they did the right functions, the right ceremonies.
All right, now you discovered this in studying about the people from the Mu civilization?
Yeah, the Mu civilization and down, you know, it's just down to the Aztecs and all this stuff. You know, you see all these guys holding these globes, and this is throughout, you know, any glyphs that you may find in just about any civilization, wherever there's a pyramidic monument sitting around. You know, whether this is fact, whether this is fiction, I don't know. I just write down what I read, what I hear through interviews, and try to put two and two together. And by being a scientist and dealing with the realities of how things actually work, you know, this could be possible. Now, what it meant back then, they didn't have a clue. But if they concentrated on their religion, on their ceremonies, and the higher ups, you know, they would be in the club and they could use these things. Unfortunately, again, we go back to these milestones. You know, why were they given to us 6,000, 10,000 years ago? We didn't have light bulbs. We didn't have things to turn off and on. Well, it was, here they are, make something happen. Well, we couldn't make anything happen until, like, what, 1700s? We didn't have round nails till 1895. So it's like, you know, we're slow learners.
Yes, we are. Yes. We are indeed. Now,
boy, we make great bows and arrows. Oh, holy cow, catapults and, oh, boy, great stuff.
Now, one of the see, that really interests me when we start talking about frequency, because first of all, that very description shows up in Genesis, where it talks about in the English translation, it says, "And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters."
Uh-huh.
That's in Genesis 1:2. And the actual translation of that from Hebrew into English, it's not "the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters." It is "the wind or breath of the gods vibrated upon the face of the waters."
There you go.
So we're talking, a vibration is a frequency.
That's correct.
All right. Now, there's that. And then in addition, Jerry Wills is a guest on this show sometimes, and Jerry does expeditions to very exotic kinds of places down in all kinds of jungles. And he's been to this doorway, and I never can say it right, but it's called the doorway of Aramuru or something like that, down in Peru. And this is supposed to be a king, the story is a king from Lemuria came there, and he came there with his wife. A carving of her is above this doorway, and the doorway is just carved, recessed into a big stone wall. But when you make certain tones in the right order, it supposedly activates this door, and it becomes sort of like what we call a stargate.
Uh-huh.
All right, we have a break taking over. And we'll step away for a few minutes for this break. The telephone number, again, ladies and gentlemen, is on your screen if you're watching KSS TV, 480-553-7232. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show and to my guest, Jay Newcomb Hodges. Jan, apparently we're getting a little help with the broadcast tonight from the outside that we didn't really expect or count on, anyway, it's there. All right, ladies and gentlemen, the telephone number is 480-553-7232. And if that's not working, I'm going to ask Don to send me a flash message and tell me that it's not working. I tested it when we moved the studio, and it was working. So if it's not working, Don, send me a flash message and tell me. All right. I was talking about this this doorway, Jan, and the thing that is interesting about that doorway is that I have interviewed some people face to face who have been there, who with Jerry, who did the tones, and who went through that doorway. And these are very feet on the ground kind of people. And it was all about frequency.
Yeah. The, you know, we'll get into some little of the physics of that. You know, we watch those Star Trek movies and they beam you up, you know, or you pass through a portal. The human brain, the consciousness, the soul, if you will, we all operate on our individual specific frequencies. You have yours, I have mine. When we get up into the terahertz, exahertz scanning devices, probably in the next 50 years, they'll discover that and be able to actually, instead of a license, a driver's license, a social security number, you'll actually have your frequency number of your soul, if you will. We have that, and then we have all the physical portions of our body, which are down on the periodic table level of frequencies, and every one of those are charted. They're in the exahertz range, basically. Now, if you were beamed up or you passed through a portal, let's take the beam up first, you would have to have two transporters, one to send your body and the other one to send essentially you, your soul, your life frequency. Now, whether that can be accomplished by this portal, I don't know. Have they solved that? I don't know. The thing is, to get both of those frequency patterns, which are in two different huge ranges, together on the other side is a major feat. Now, if we're dealing with a civilization that came down 78,000 years ago, I think this is a piece of cake. You know, but for us to figure it out, you know, I don't think we even want to try at this point. We're not even close to coming up with a device that can even... in the terahertz range, so because
all right.
any device we built today is basically silicon based, and silicon breaks down at about 300 gigahertz, you know, 300 to 700, somewhere in there. So you know, we can't even reach that range yet.
All right, let's go to the telephone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. This is Don calling from Phoenix.
Hi, Don.
Apparently, your phone number's working.
Okay.
But when you announced that, you just came back up.
All right.
You were down for quite a while. In fact, when you announced you're going to start taking calls, you went down and, and an archive show was playing.
What was playing?
The Inner Earth archive show was playing.
Okay. How strange.
From your current shirt to a red shirt, and I knew automatically something was wrong.
Okay. Well, thanks for letting me know, Don.
Okay.
All right. Yeah, when I announced that we were going to open and, the phones and take calls, then we started immediately getting interference. So there may be someone that doesn't want your message out there, Jan.
Well, that's not the first time, my friend. You can check with Mr. Bell and those guys. They'll tell you the same stories.
Well, I'm not surprised. We get that outside help from... from the very people who say they're that we're the freest nation on earth. Oh, my, my.
I read that.
Yeah, I read that somewhere, too. Now, look, you mentioned that we have a frequency for our soul, if you will.
Yeah.
And that it's going to be in the future on our driver's license. Is that right?
Well, here's a scenario. Let's say 50 years, 100 years from now, your first day of school at kindergarten, you're put into a little box, and you put on some headphones, and you're listening to some music, la, la, la. All the time you're being scanned.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to pick up your number. It could be like a 300-digit number. I mean, it's humongous. But what it is, it's tracking your individual exact frequency. And from that point on, that's your number. Now, that's a pretty neat thing, I guess. But it's also... they can manipulate that number. Okay, I'll give you two different possible weird things here. Let's say let's say you're convicted of a major crime, a mass murder, instead of putting you to death, they can essentially take that frequency in the future and put it into a cessation gel and put you into a lawnmower to mow the sides of the highways for the next 150 years. Or it could put you in to a little device that would go inside of an underwater submarine if you're a microbiologist or something, go down and do in the water, in the oceans, or up on planets, you know. So, you know, this is kind of ways out there, but that, you know, it's a reality that could happen. Now, let's just take it, you know, we got some people out there, maybe this life after death and this reincarnation stuff. Let's just say you get on Yahoo and there's some five-year-old kid that can play Beethoven or something. Well, let's say in the future, if Beethoven had been alive and they scanned his frequency, it was the exact same frequency as this kid. But that means this kid's picking up frequency emissions from the same life soul that existed then, because you can't destroy energy. You know, it's a possibility. You know, that's maybe the reincarnation thing. That's maybe why you can do things that you were never trained to do, because somebody 100 years ago, 6,000 years ago, had the exact same frequency number as yours down to the 350th digit.
Wow.
So this is the type of technology that's going to be existing in the future that's going to tap into us. And this portal stuff, this transport stuff, could be a reality. And maybe, as you said, maybe it's already happened 6, 10, 15, 75,000 years ago, and we're just finding some remnants that are still operational. So, I don't know, my friend. I'm going along for the ride. I'm sitting on this rock with you. I'm just...
Well, let's go back to the phone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hello, Kevin. It's Mike from Kentucky.
Hi, Mike.
How you doing?
I'm doing well, except I can hear another radio station in the background.
I hear that also. Plus, I'm looking at a screen. It says that I am blocked by network administrator. Every time I click F5, it goes for a minute, and then it keeps cutting you out. And
we're getting outside help, Mike.
Yeah, I understand. I'm hearing enough of the show basically to pick up bits and pieces, you know, of conversation. And he was talking about this subterranean jeweled city. Now, these individuals who reside there, what do they look like, supposedly?
You mean in the aliens, if you will?
Yes.
I don't really describe them. I don't want to... All right, let's just say, okay, if a civilization builds triangular craft that we call Malika. You can put that in your reference. Build a Malika craft. They don't have long, spindly fingers. They're going to have fingers just like us. They're going to have manufacturing capabilities. They're going to have factories. They're going to have the same type of motive skills as we have. So if you imagine what an alien would look like, they're pretty darn close to us. Okay, in order to build craft that look the way they do, to have the technology that they have, to utilize water the way they need it. We look at some of these, you know, I think the closest thing we come to, you know, you say the grays, okay, yeah, that's pretty close. But they look more like us than has been touted in the past. So.
Well, you know, the first time I ever saw or heard of a gray, that's been 20 years plus ago. The first thing I thought when I looked at the description, this looked like something that not came from some other planet, but came from a inner Earth or something where there's no light. They don't have any body hair. They don't have any coloration like they would get if they, or pigmentation. And they have the large eyes, which tend to indicate they live in a low-light civilization. But then everybody started
much
talking
light
about
their
reticula and so forth and so forth. But that wasn't my first impression.
Yeah, there's not much light out there. There's no need for a lot of light, but there's a need for heat. There's a need for water, not CO2 ice, regular H2O ice. So what you're going to be finding is... we're going to be looking at trans-Neptunian objects that are just outside their solar system in the, I think it's the Kuiper Belt, There's planets or planetoids like Orcus and things like that that are ice-covered. We have some moons here in our solar system that are ice-covered. You know, that's where we're going to be finding a lot of interesting things. And it's not going to be on the surface. It's going to be below, and there's not much light there. So there's some clues.
Okay, Mike, thanks for the call. Good questions. You know, we were talking about this transport device, and you said, you know, if this came from a civilization that was from 75,000, 78,000 years ago, who knows? Maybe they had this, and I think you said I think for them it would be a piece of cake. So let me ask you this, and to our caller that's on the line, let me ask you, are you willing to hang on through the break if we need to?
Sure, Kevin.
All right. You're a scientist. You're one of the top scientists in this nation. You have heard and seen a lot of evidence that has been given by astronauts and military pilots, commercial pilots, etc., about the existence of extraterrestrials. What do you think? Do they exist?
That's a yes or no answer, correct?
Yes, it is.
My own beliefs.
No, I don't want to know what you believe now. What do you think based on the evidence?
From the evidence?
Uh-huh.
From the evidence, it all stacks up to yes. But I'm a scientist. Uh-huh. When one walks up on my doorstep and says, "Hey, Jan, you know, I love your books. You want to go have a beer?" You know, then maybe I will believe. But as far as the evidence, I have to go on scientific information that's come in through sources for the last, you know, 50, 100, 200 years, even way back. You know, they say they exist.
Well, now let me ask you a question. I'm sort of ambushing you on this one.
Sure are.
All right. Have you ever taken a bottle of hydrochloric acid and just cupped your hand and poured the bottle of acid into your hand?
No, I haven't done it intentionally, but I've had hydrochloric acid on my hand. Yes.
Okay.
By doing stupid things.
Have you ever put phosphorus into your hand?
Yes.
And did it burn?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I'll get to the rest of that when we come back. I'll let you worry about it during the break. We'll be back, folks, right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is J. Newcomb Hodges, one of the top scientists in America. caller, are you still with me?
Yes, I am.
All right, hang in there. I'll be with you in just a second. You have spilt hydrochloric acid on your hand, and it burned, right?
Yeah, that is correct.
Okay. You have had phosphorus in your hand, and it burned, right?
That is correct.
If you tell me, as a credentialed scientist, that hydrochloric acid is not good for my hand, would it be foolish for me to not accept your testimony?
Yes, it would be.
When an astronaut says to the controllers down in Houston, we still have the alien spacecraft under observance, I would think that the astronaut is in that situation credentialed, and for me to not take his word would be foolish.
That is correct, and I've heard that same transmission.
Yeah, and so the reason I say that is I don't believe in UFOs, and I don't believe in doorknobs, and I don't believe in beer cans, and I don't believe in Volkswagens. They exist, and I know they exist, and I think UFOs' existence is just as established as Volkswagens. However,
yes.
I don't know who's driving UFOs. Let's go to the telephone and caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, good evening, gentlemen. This is Terry from Ohio.
Hi, Terry.
Hi. I was wondering, does he know anything about biology? Because I remember asking you if you ever heard about the Adam gene, where they can only trace the Y chromosome back to, 6,700 years? But there is, other scientists say that it's always being destroyed and created, but if that was the case, wouldn't we mutate?
Okay, what about that, Jen?
Well, okay, there's some scientific things involved here that, H3, it's an element, deuterium oxide. Now, it exists everywhere. In fact, it exists more within nuclear power plants, but it exists everywhere in nature. Now, H3, deuterium oxide, what it does is when it gets in your system, your chromosomes, your DNA, think essentially that it's hydrogen. And unfortunately, it gets in there and it breaks the chain. So when the cells mutate or the chromosomes go to their next level, they don't quite match up. Now, it doesn't happen to everybody. Well, it does happen to everybody. That's what causes old age, you know, because they don't reproduce, you know, the same every time. So after a while, 3,200 years, you know, things kind of fall apart, and it worked backwards. So there's one explanation. Now, I know what Terry's getting at here is, you know, where do we come from? You know, were we transported here? Are we essentially in vitro'd from another civilization? Well, that wouldn't surprise me, let's say that. You know, we had the early days of abduction. You know, I was abducted and they did all this and yada, yada. You know, they took my eggs and all this stuff. That really isn't necessary anymore because, you know, we're going into probably a different phase here. We have in vitro, and maybe we're getting ready for the next level here. Maybe the 3,200 years is kicking in again. So it's, you know, it brings up a lot of questions. You know, I know what you're saying, Terry, and I've been struggling with that also for quite a while here. And, you know, because, you know, how come everything starts 6,000 years ago? You know, and you half that's 3,000. So every 3,000 years, what the heck's going on? We're in the next phase, the next 3,000 years. You know, you can build these charts and graphs that cover a wall, you know, and follow them back, you know, like I've been doing with the legends. And at some point, things stop, and they start again. And it's like every 3,000 years, some darn thing stops, and something else starts. We're going to get some answers, and I think they're going to come pretty quick here. I think we're pretty much up to a point where technology will allow us to take the next step, and things are going to start falling into place, and the big light bulbs are going to come on. We're going to go, holy cow. And unfortunately, we're not going to know about it right away because it's going to scare the masses. So,
all right. We've just got a few minutes left in tonight's show, and Jan, you this afternoon when I talked with you on the telephone, you made a special offer for our listeners, and I'd like for you to share that with our listeners and tell them how they can get this book and help this show at the same time.
Okay, well, Kevin, you know I'm a great fan of your show here, and everybody listening is too. And what I've offered is I have the mushroom farms available, and I'm going to give everybody who donates $10 or more to your site in the next week a signed copy of Mushroom Farms, and I'll send it right to their house. But it's got to be $10 or more. We got to keep you going, my friend. And this is the way I'm going to try to help support you. So, and I want all the listeners to support you also.
Well, I'll tell you, I appreciate it tremendously, and I mean that from the bottom of my heart. Folks, you got to get this book, and you can either go over to Amazon and buy it, or you can donate $10 or more to this show and receive it as a thank you gift from the author. And
I think Amazon's selling this thing for like $15 or some crazy thing, so.
All right, so there you go, folks. So you can go over to my website, click on where it says donate, and just make a donation of $10 or more, and then Jan will send you a signed copy of the book, and you can read it for yourself. Now, Jan, let me ask you, as a scientist, what you think, and we've only got like 30 to 45 seconds here for this, but what do you think about all the hullabaloo about Planet X or Nibiru? Does that thing exist?
No, I wouldn't sweat that at all. Don't sweat that, people. There's other things to worry about. Don't worry about that.
All right. What if it does show up?
Well, I'll be over in Bangkok with you. I'll talk about it.
It's going to be a good party. I've already started taking a look at the bands to invite.
I'll be buying if it shows up.
Well, it'll be one heck of a sight in the sky if it does show up, and there will be many, many disturbances upon the planet and the solar system if it shows up. Jan, I want to thank you for being with us. It's been fascinating, and I hope you'll come back and talk with us again. I'd like to talk with you. I'd like to get into some of the exotic propulsion systems that are being proposed and some of the ideas, the science behind some of those.
Gravity push stuff?
Yeah.
Yep.
And, you know, we talked briefly about that on the phone today. But I'd like to sort of get into that and talk about when is it going to be possible for us to get out there to these other planets. I think it's probably possible now. The general public just doesn't know about it. But I think it probably is.
Maybe on the next show.
All right. All right, if you will, just stay online with me for a moment as I close the show. I want to talk with you for just a moment after I go off the air. Again, thanks for being with us. All right, folks, that's a wrap. Don't forget, go over to my website, make a donation, $10 or more, and Jan will send you your own signed copy of The Mushroom Farms, his book about the coming calamity in 2012. All right. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you wish to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.